We had our one-day retreat, Zenhard Vajrahat retreat. I taught with Paladin up in Fairfax, temporary space. She's in the process of building out her new, rather nice center in downtown Fairfax. So the next time we do one, it'll be there. So that'll be great. The theme was life itself is the path, which I think we both agree is the point of Dharma in our age. And but we did a lot of traditional practice, and one of the things that is so clear when Paul and I teach together is that the shamatha or stability of mind, concentration practice in both traditions is basically the same, except that like with everything, that Tibetans are much more spelled out, much more detailed. There's a lot more teaching, there's a lot more instruction. And I think we're hobbled a bit in the style of Japanese Zen, because the general pedagogy of Japanese culture is you don't explain things, you just watch and pick it up. It's very physical, whether it's tea ceremony or martial arts or, you know, anything, pottery. You just apprentice yourself to somebody who knows how to do it, and you learn it by feel. Well, it doesn't work that well for Westerners at all, particularly since we have no feel for what Buddhism is. So in the spirit of being much more explicit, I'm going to continue my exploration of breathing and concentration in a pretty specific way, much more detailed than you're likely to find most other places. And I put out, for anybody who hasn't seen it, a few copies of an old set of talks I gave many years ago, which are called Zen Basics, which has in it a lot of what I'm going to be talking about. So if any of you want to take one up there on the table, you can see what I said several years ago, see if I've changed my mind on anything. But just to review the, and one thing they say in Tibetan Buddhism is that the path is 80% shamatha and 20% vipassana. So what they mean by that is, and it's kind of a joke, because actually the only thing that matters is vipassana or insight or transformation, but you can't really come to that without stability. And so a lot of the, most of the work of meditation, most of the, you might say, the hours you clock are really cultivating and maintaining stability. And so in both traditions, the breath is the central object of concentration. Although again, in Tibetan tradition, there are many more. And I think as part of this series, I'm going to teach a few more. One that I have taught before years ago, Calm Lake, is a visualization practice or imagination practice, and some people find it very effective. And I put it in my new book as one of the practices. And going along with that is Granite Cliff. Paulden says that in the Tibetan tradition, women tend to like Calm Lake, and men like Granite Cliff. So we'll see how that goes. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. So we know about counting the breath, and I mentioned how much more sense it makes in Japanese than in English to count the breath, because the Japanese numbers all end in U. We have what we call following the breath. But there are many other styles and variations of this that I want to go into tonight. Actually have you try each one for a few minutes, then we can talk about it. A little bit different format than just, you know, I'll give a talk and you comment. So counting the breath, actually, there's three ways to do it. You can count just the inhales, which typically we don't do in Zen. You can count the inhales and the exhales, and you can just count the exhale. I think Suzuki Roshi liked teaching just the exhale. And so maybe we'll start with that because that may be the most familiar to you. I'm hopeful we can all be candid here, and this is not a test to see how well you can do. Suzuki Roshi himself counted his breath sometimes when he was agitated. So, as I've often said, whether or not you have lots of thoughts, a few thoughts or no thoughts, just depends on your condition. If you had a bad day, you'll have lots of thoughts. If a relative is dying, you'll have lots of emotions. If everything's just going great and you just got back from vacation in Hawaii, you may still be pretty blissed out and you may not have many thoughts at all. It doesn't matter. In fact, lest you think that Zen is some kind of competition to see who can have the least thoughts, in some ways, having more disturbance in your mind is an opportunity for a deeper practice. Some people are drawn to meditation because their natural, how shall I put it, they can fall into a kind of blissful state very quickly. And I've known a few people like this. They can sit full lotus, they come to a retreat, and they usually keep their eyes closed, and they just sit like that for days and days. Unfortunately, if you actually talk to them or ask them what's going on, they have no idea. In other words, nothing's really happening, but they're really enjoying it. This is too much shamatha, or the wrong kind of shamatha. Shamatha is only important in Buddhism if it leads to insight. And in particular, if it leads to enough stability that you can actually walk out of here and maintain your concentration in the world. We're Mahayanists, and our fundamental practice is bodhisattva vows. So what's really important is not how well you can sit when you're in a meditation hall. It's how well you can maintain clarity in a crazy situation. So I've often had a fantasy, which I've never actually done, of on the fourth or fifth day of Sesshin, take everybody to the shopping center and just sit down in the middle of the mall with the teenagers and the noise and everything and just see how everybody does. If people say, well, this is awful, I can't concentrate, I mean, this is just terrible, let's go back, this is awful, this isn't Zen, I'm thinking, well, those people can leave now. The people who can stay there and just adjust to, okay, this is the situation. And in particular, those that can say, is there an opportunity to turn the wheel of the Dharma? And once you have that intention, wherever you are, the answer is always yes. In other words, you create the opportunity simply by having that intention. There is no square inch of the planet that we live on that doesn't need Dharma, where people aren't suffering. So there's no, I don't care how blissful, whether you're in a 5-star hotel in Thailand on the beach in the blazing sun with a Mai Tai or whatever they serve there. Actually, if you are, the opportunity to turn the wheel of the Dharma is yourself. You might want to take a look at what you're doing. Although I know a very prominent Buddhist teacher who regularly goes to such a place, actually exactly that kind of place, once a year to rest up. So I'm not saying it's bad. So I digress. Getting back to the breath. So let's just start. I've changed my mind. I don't actually think counting is the most basic breath practice. I think just feeling your breath and sensing your breath is the most basic. So let's just, for a couple of minutes, feel inhaling, exhaling, and resting. This is the three-part breath, which I've talked about. You inhale, you exhale, and there's a little bit of time after the exhale where you just rest and wait for the next breath to come. And it's a very, one of the things that's very important is that as you exhale, you don't put too much pressure on the exhale. You just let it dissolve very lightly and then just rest in that space until the inhale gathers itself. So I'm going to do it first without sounds, inner sounds or syllables, and then with sounds. So let's just, for about a minute, let's just, you don't have to be all in Zazen posture. Remember, if you're in the shopping mall, you're not in Zazen posture, so you have to be able to do this. Actually, you have to, one of the signs of somebody mature in their practice is that at some level, wherever you go, you can always feel your breath. Even in the most distracted situation. So this is kind of a, it's not just a exercise, it's a kind of transformation of your body so that you have a constant sense of centering and physicality in the breath. So let's just feel it. Inhaling, exhaling, rest. The three parts aren't necessarily equal in time. Doesn't matter. Remember, we keep the eyes open, half open, in this practice. See if you can notice the first moment when you start to get distracted. Okay. So let's stop. As one of the early Zen teachers used to say, now don't meditate. don't meditate. So what happened? Anything to report? Is that a little different, the three-part breath, than what you're accustomed to doing? Yeah.
Well, it is for me because I don't think I stop, you know, and rest. And I had some effort. I noticed some effort trying, you know, stopping.
You don't stop. It's not a matter of stopping, exactly. It's more like the exhale just gets fainter and fainter, and there's a quality of waiting very in a very relaxed way for the inhale to come. Is that not the feeling you have?
Well, I think I was actually trying to stop. I think when normally it feels just more like breath in, breath out, breath in, breath out. Sometimes faster, sometimes slower. So this time I was trying breath in, breath out, stop. You know, just trying to hold, and I felt myself.
No, that's not. Holding. You don't need to do that. That'll create tension.
Yeah, that's what I was feeling, tension.
Yeah, it's really just what you said. It's in and out, but the out has a kind of tail, which the in doesn't have. And that tail is what I mean by rest, you know. It can be very short. It can just be kind of the, it can be a short tail or a long tail. It's whatever it is. doesn't have to be the same with each breath either. Sometimes the tail is long, sometimes the tail is short, sometimes there's hardly any tail at all. But it's just that place where the exhale is just dying away, and it, you know, there's a bottom to your breath, you know. It's not stopping though. That would be there are all kinds of pranayama exercises, if you've, any of you have ever done yoga, where you stop the breath in all sorts of ways. And actually there are Tibetan breath practices where you you do all sorts of things to expel air and move the prana. We're not doing that. You know, that's not the point. Well, anyway, just roll. Now that you know you don't have to stop, just roll along as I sort of guide this and see if it feels better.
Okay.
Yeah. Anybody else? Anybody catch themselves getting distracted or anything? Yeah.
I had a kind of the same experience that Carol did, in that I remember you talking before how there is a moment of death on the exhale, you know, way in the past. There is that feeling of kind of it's all over, you know, because it is all going away. And that's when my thoughts came in, because there is a lot of anxiety at that point. There is a feeling of nothingness. So then I did notice it pretty distinctly at that low where it's all fading away.
Well, that's one way. I mean, Suzuki Roshi does talk about it that way sometimes. And I think particularly at times when we do have a lot of anxiety, the bottom of the breath is where the anxiety kind of starts to arise. So the feeling is extremely gentle. We'll do it now with some syllables, and we'll see if that's different. But the feeling is... as you let yourself exhale, it's just, there's a kind of openness that comes. You kind of feel just some expansion or quality of wholeness, and then you know, very smooth. The whole thing is very, the deeper you go, the more smooth it gets. So there's actually not really any parts, you know. Let's try it with some syllables. I think I mentioned last time that the Qigong syllable for the stomach is hu, which is the syllable that ends all the Japanese numbers. So let's, as we do our three-part breath, again, being very relaxed and not trying to make any effort or any stopping, imagine the inhale as being the sound ah, and the exhale is hu. And then that space as the exhale trails away is just kind of a mm. You know, the hu kind of closes and becomes an mm. Ah.
So it's
Huh?
Ah-oh-hoo.
It could be. I'm not going to stress the point. But let me just digress. You know, back in the early days, transcendental meditation was very popular. Did any of you do TM? Yeah, that's right. You talked about that. Why was TM so popular? Why was it so effective? Because it was a mantra practice. And... you know, mantra, a seed syllable mantra is the easiest way to become concentrated for a while, because it suppresses words. It's very simple, and you know, you, instead of a word, you have a sound. And so all the verbal equipment, which is vast in your brain, to create words and thoughts that are verbal, is funneled into this sound, and it inhibits chatter, you know. So so there is so when I'm adding these sounds, these inner sounds, it's a way of collecting that quality to make the breath practice a little bit more concentrated. These are just experiments, so let's try. So, you know, not aloud, but you know. So just an inward sound. Let's just try that for a few minutes. You don't want to change your breath at all. You don't want to do anything with your breath. Just follow your breath with the inner sounds. Let the breath just go its own way, whatever it wants to do. Okay, let's not meditate, just relax. Actually, this moment of not meditating is really important, but I'm not going to talk about it tonight. So how was that? How was that different? Did it feel easier? Did it feel harder? Did it feel unnatural? Did it feel more concentrated, less concentrated? Artificial.
More concentrated, and after a few breaths, the breath was kind of breathing the body rather than the body breathing the breath. So it's very calming.
You like it?
Yeah, and actually, I've taken all the numbers and I end them in U when I do count.
Oh, good.
And yeah, it does fill space until the mind, you know, things slow down and I kind of get into the rhythm of what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll take things one step at a time, but those are good observations. That's right. As long as you don't get involved in trying to manhandle or womanhandle the breath and make it go your way, then, and you let the breath, as you say, the breath start to breathe you, that's one of the early feelings of concentration, is a sense that the breath, that you're joining something that has a life of its own, rather than that you're giving life to it. That's a kind of first level of surrender, which is good. Anybody else? Yeah.
I found that I had a surprising amount of, I thought it was surprising amount of resistance to that last felt like filling the gap or cutting off the tail or something unnatural, and my mind, body just didn't want to add anything to the and the ooh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't. I mean, actually, you know, counting the breath the way that Donna said, or the way that Suzuki Roshi taught, you just follow the ooh all the way down. And you can do that. That's fine.
Yeah, I think I just felt like I was very attached to doing that.
Well, you know, there's no one way. And the point here is to come up with a small library of techniques that you can use to stabilize. Remember, 80% shamatha, 20% vipassana. We're always working, you know, lifelong on stabilization. Because unlike what we thought when we were 20, you never get to a place where it's all downhill from there on out. You know, it's always uphill to your last breath. You know, because of the bodhisattva vow, even if you're not carrying something yourself, you're starting to carry everybody else, and they're depending on you. So actually, you just start carrying more and more and walking up a steeper and steeper hill. So you have to work at this all the time. You can think of this as kind of a counting to three in a special language that, you know, we're just inventing. And the is more like just the end of the who, you know, just to make sure it finishes. Okay, ready for the next one? This time we're just going to do who. No ah, just who. So this puts a little bit more emphasis. This is more Suzuki Roshi's style, puts a little more emphasis on the exhale or on the surrender or letting go part of the breath. And what it will tend to do is make your exhale a little longer over time. So don't even think about the inhale so much, but when you start to exhale, just have in your mind who. It's really just the sound of sighing, actually. It's the sound that it is. So let's just do that. See if you can feel the difference in the flavor of just concentrating on exhaling. Let your eyes close a bit more than usual, so it's a little bit less than half. All right, a couple more breaths. And now let go of the breath completely and let your eyes open almost completely wide. Just look naturally. Not completely straight ahead, but, you know, out to maybe the knees of the person across the rug. Can you feel the increased concentration in the room? The room is getting much more concentrated. I can feel it. So how was that? What was the different? Was there a different feeling to that? How did that feel? Everybody's so concentrated, nobody wants to say anything.
It's very soothing.
Huh?
It's very soothing, especially at this hour of the day.
Yeah.
You know.
Did you get a different flavor of just doing the exhale versus doing inhale and exhale? How would you characterize that difference?
I think it was a little easier.
Easier?
Yeah, it's good. Take a breath in and then focus on the breath.
The out-breath was longer.
The out-breath was longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I began to really feel some concentration in the room with this exercise. So, yeah. I think that this is kind of home base, this kind of practice. It's basic Zen breath practice. You can always go here. But these other practices are good when you're very distracted. Or, you know, if you sit down and there's just a lot going on, the day is swirling around in your head. In those situations, if you can have something to yoke your inhale, and yoke your exhale and yoke your rest, all three, the three-part breath will kind of collect your breath. And then once it's collected and you feel you have some stability, then you can let the breath sink and concentrate more on the exhale.
It feels like something would be very good to have in your back pocket at the moment.
Yeah. Now, Suzuki Roshi often said, and this is very, you know, Chinese-Japanese feeling, he said, you should develop some strength in your stomach when you sit. So a lot of us young men thought he meant, you know, like that. There is that kind of martial arts warrior kind of strength, which if you study hard martial arts like karate, they'll teach that, you know, and they'll teach the breath as a way to gain kind of a power. He didn't mean that kind of power. The power of Zazen is like the power of the wind or the power of the surf. You know, it feels very soft inside, but it has a tremendous absorptive quality. It's very transparent and what he means by power is he means the power to face things, to just hold things, to just be with things. That's much more powerful, actually, than the kind of sort of macho martial arts power, which is very, actually very thin and has a shadow of tremendous insecurity behind it. You know, I'm going to be so powerful that nobody can get to me, like a cowboy. This is the opposite of that. This is like the power of a bamboo, a thin bamboo sprig that cannot be broken by the wind, no matter how stormy it gets, you know, that kind of power. So I misunderstood that. I think most of us did for a long time, because he never explained what he meant by power. He just said, you know, develop some, strength. He said, develop some strength here. But it doesn't mean, you know, that's kind of a fantasy, samurai fantasy. It means, it's like when you're sitting next to the bedside of a dying person, it's the strength to just be there in a very relaxed, matter-of-fact way. That's incredibly powerful, if you can have that kind of strength. But there's nothing... you know, am I making sense? You understand the difference? It's a different kind of strength than what you'd think of as strength. It's almost a kind of it's very delicate kind of feeling. Well, let's top things off by actually trying some counting. I wanted to put it off to the end because for a lot of people, counting is like a test, you know. You're judging yourself when you count. It's like, and I know people who, their idea of Zen was the minute they had one thought, they would go back to one. They punished themselves, you know. So one, two, three, thought, back to one, bad, you know. And until they could get to 10 without a single thought, perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the old phrase? That and a is it that and a quarter will get you, I don't know.
Subway ride.
Huh?
That and a nickel will get you a cup of coffee.
That's right. That and a nickel will get you a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
You know, people spend years doing that. I think I probably went through a phase of doing that too. You know, how perfect can I make it? Remember, I talked about stability, the image being like not that there's necessarily a cloudless sky, but that you can see the sky in, you know, in the clouds are all broken up. So the point of counting is not to count perfectly, but just to do it, however it turns out, and without judgment. That's very important. So let's do three counts of 10. And I like Donna's idea. How do you do it? Maybe you can explain how you add ooh into English numbers.
Oh, just kind of played with it, and it's like one is ooh,
uh-huh.
Two is two, three is through,
uh-huh.
Four is foo.
Uh-huh, I see.
And so on.
Uh-huh.
And I just kind of played with it. And
How do four and five differ?
Foo and fru. And then sue.
Well, it's true. You do it all any way that you want. But there's two important things. Try not to lose count, and try to notice when you get to 10. If you're at 23, then you've lost it a little bit. You know, just but whatever happens, whenever you notice, just go back. You know, no judgment. Why don't you hit the bell? Give me the bell, and I'll do it just so that we feel like we have a beginning and an end here.
So we should be doing it on the exhale.
Yeah.
At the top of the exhale, beginning.
Well, not exactly the top, but as you exhale, wherever it feels comfortable, just note a very light noting of the number of the breath. You know, one. And you can, if you want to do Donna's way, you can add an ooh feeling in there too, or not. So, how did we do? Any reports from meditation land?
Well, I got to the third set. Five was where I stopped when you get the...
I breathe a little faster than you.
To me, it's always non as close is my usual practice, which is to turn in, is what we call it. And I can kind of get from what you've explained it, this is when you see other people that have their eyes closed and they are in one place and that's it. And so to me that's always the best. And so the other to me is not as quiet.
Well, it's not. You're right. But if you're very distracted, it's a good gate. About other people. Did it feel different counting at the end of the day, at the end of the evening, doing all these other meditations? Did you seem more concentrated, more tired? I don't know. How did you? How, what was different about it?
I was practicing the, because I was thinking a lot on the inhale, so I was doing the ah for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that really did stabilize things. And then I was able to just let the inhale be and have the number. I tended to drag out the number, you know, down through the whole exhale. But I think it all is a real benefit. And I can see how you can make the habit so you can develop stability. So that's what I was experimenting with just in that chunk of time.
Yeah, it's good to experiment because part of the reason to have some different flavors of doing this is that different people have different affinities for one or the other. Yeah.
I found it a lot much easier than I expected to get to 10. I haven't tried counting to 10 in a long, long time, and I don't know how it would have been if it was the first exercise of the evening, or if it's just that something's been happening during the last X number of whatevers.
So it went pretty easily.
Way more than I expected. I didn't even trust it. You know.
Well,
but that's me.
Here's a little safety tip from Egon, as I like to quote the Ghostbusters: most people who don't sit could not even get to 3. You've got to remember how distracted most people are. Mm. Enormously distracted. And you don't, this is what he means by strength in your stomach. You know, this is a strength, a hidden strength that you don't know you have until you're called upon to use it. So, you know, don't sell yourself short. All of you have been sitting for, you know, quite a while, and I can feel it. This is not a beginner's group. Otherwise I wouldn't be teaching this way, you know. And but I want to go into a lot of detail because, you know, typically in Zen places, people just come and sit down and just they're quiet and there's no discussion about what is it that we're doing, what practice are we actually practicing. Just to close for tonight, I want to remind you that these texts of Dogen on Zazen that we've been studying never mention the breath. So the actual practice of Zen that is our core practice is something other than what we've been doing tonight, but it's closely related to it. And not wanting to leave you in suspense, I'll just say that, you know, our core practice is to sit in clear, stable awareness, period, with the eyes naturally open. One of the things that, you know, when we were with Suzuki Roshi, we watched him pretty closely, and there are photos of him doing Zazen, and he did not actually close his eyes at all. Mm-hmm. His eyes were just completely normally open, just like this, which is the transmitted instruction in Tibetan Buddhism as well. In fact, they even have you look slightly up in contrast to the concentration stability exercises of looking down. And they also, there are instructions to light up the room or to sit in bright sunlight so you really have a sense of being fully awake and aware. So when Suzuki Roshi did Zazen, even though he told us to lower the gaze, and that is the standard instruction for shamatha, it's not the instruction for what we call shikantaza, or just sitting in pure awareness. And sitting in pure awareness, the eyes are more open. So in future sessions, I want to have us practice with the eyes in various ways. Close the eyes, see what that feels like. Open them just a little bit, open them halfway, open them all the way, because the eyes are like a regulator for how your mental state is. And each of those positions of the eyes creates a different mental state and has just different uses in practice. So, were you going to say something? No. You look very awake just then.
No, after all that concentrated sitting, I feel some energy.
Yeah. Well, I learned a great, we had a young yoga teacher at the retreat on Saturday, and I thought, yoga, it's going to be hard. It wasn't. And to end tonight, rather than doing the three vows, I'll do one of her little exercises. Oh, okay.